Hey guys, in this episode I spoke with poet, journalist, and educator Mike Songson, aka Mike the Poet. In our conversation, we talk about how Mike got into writing, the importance of poetry and self-expression and in connecting with place, learning how to feel, and how to develop and grow in a craft, and much more. Mike is a third-generation Los Angeles native and teaches at Woodbury University, where he serves as the program coordinator of the school's first-year experience program. He has published over 500 essays and poems with publications like Academy of American Poets, Alta Journal, KCET, Poets and Writers Magazine, PBS, LA Weekly, and tons more. Over the last two decades, Mike has delivered more than 2,000 poetry readings across the country in a range of venues, including bookstores, museums, galleries, schools, and literary festivals. He's been a guest speaker at over 100 universities and high schools and has presented his poetry on public radio stations such as KCRW, KPFK, and KPCC, and TV stations like Spectrum News. In 2013, the Beyond Baroque Literary Arts Center honored Mike for distinguished service to the Los Angeles poetry community. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Mike Songson. Perhaps we could start off with how you got into poetry. I think that that would be interesting because I really, for this conversation, I'm really interested in getting into your focus on Los Angeles, your focus on the notion of place and how writing culturally relates to that, the aspects of place. So how did you get into poetry? What was that journey kind of like for you in Los Angeles?
Thank you. That's a great question. You know, to be quite honest, I owe so much of who I am from not only to poetry, but to the Los Angeles poetry community. And it's really where I started to find my identity, my purpose, and it led me into teaching. And there's a few different answers to the story, but well, number one, in the early 90s, I graduated from high school in 1992. And I was a big music fan, and I was going to a lot of concerts, and I was going to hip hop shows and punk shows. And I mean, I saw Rage Against the Machine and Far Side and Sublime and Green Day and Tribe Called Quest and De La Soul and Freestyle Fellowship and all these groups as they were coming up and becoming famous. And my friends and I hit a lot of shows. Okay. And I was deep in the art scene and the music scene. And I was always scribbling in my journal and scribbling in my notebook. And my mom is somebody who's been keeping a journal since she was 9 years old. And so The idea of journaling was always with me. And I started writing a lot of little short poems. And some of it was to capture the adventures I was having and the places that I was going. And we'd take a hike through Elysian Park and watch the sunset over Dodger Stadium. And just, you know, some of it was young romance and kind of right. – And initially, I would just maybe share my poem with my girlfriend in the dorm room at UCLA or something. But there's a few things that happened. And I had a buddy of mine who almost believed in me more than, you know, than I believed in myself. And he was an all-star soccer player. And he's still an award. Now he's a soccer coach. But he had a soccer scholarship to UCLA. But he secretly wrote poems.
Okay.
And so, like, he and I started going to a lot of open mics.
Okay.
And At the time, you know, we would just, like I said, we'd read our poems to our girlfriends or, you know, in the backyard apartment party of everybody at our friends at UCLA. But little by little, we started hitting open mics. And then before you know it, we actually started performing at open mics. Okay. And at the whole time, I was writing essays too. And I studied with Mike Davis in 1997. But even before I studied with Mike Davis, I was reading all of his work and I was reading different California historians. And I had initially wanted to go to graduate school in urban planning, but I was 23. I was declined from urban planning graduate school. At the time, I hadn't done any internships. I was more of a self-taught kind of autodidact guy who read a million books on his own. Mm-hmm. And also my grandfather never went to college, but he was a real self-taught guy who could have gone to college, but he worked on the Union Pacific Railroad in LA in the 30s, okay. Late 30s, early 40s. And my grandfather got me hooked on LA history. And so he was always this just real salt of the earth kind of guy who had friends in every neighborhood. And so My grandfather taught me this love of LA, and my dad knew a lot of – my dad actually worked for the City of Los Angeles in the late 60s for the Department of Recreations and Parks. Okay. And later on, he went to Loyola Law School, and he told me he never should have quit that job with the City of Los Angeles. That was – if he would have stayed there, he'd have a pension of $106,000 a year right now.
Oh, my gosh.
He always told me – he always told me, get a government job, da-da-da-da-da. But anyway, he ended up going off and being an entrepreneur and an attorney and kind of had a real roller coaster career. But anyway, I was number one. I was like, I'm not going to be like my dad. So I went in sort of another direction. But the thing my dad and I did have in common is we do both love Southern California. We do both love Los Angeles. And my grandfather was just a guy who loved the city. And so my dad and my grandfather and I would, and it was both separately, sometimes together, but a lot of times separately. I spent a childhood driving around LA all the time. And my grandfather would tell me stories about this and that. And so I had this sort of self-taught love. But to come back to how I got into poetry was that the poetry was immediate. I was writing these essays, and my first things I was getting published on, besides a couple of poems, were little short record reviews. But what the poetry scene did for me was this immediacy. You can go to an open mic, you can write a poem this afternoon and go perform it tonight. And so what the poetry scene was about was instant feedback, but also, and I've said this a lot before, but in the mid-90s, most of us were coming out of, not all of us, but a lot of us, maybe 7 out of 10 of us, were coming out of divorced families. And LA was a lot of gangs at the time, and not, none of my friends were, we weren't into that, but it was around us. Everybody knew somebody who was somebody, you know, and there was, and so for us, the art scene was our chance to make the family we always wanted and to also kind of find our own place. And a lot of my friends were DJs, and I knew some friends of mine that were graffiti artists, and my wife is a painter, you know, and she had wanted to go into fashion and into our art, and she ended up getting into our art eventually. But for a time, my wife was a flight attendant, and, you know, cause my mother-in-law was old fashioned and, but the short answer to my long roundabout way of saying all this was that the poetry scene was very immediate. And so there was a time where there was many topics where I wrote both poems and essays about. Like, I might write a 3,000-word essay on something, but I might write a little poem that was 200-300 words. And so, like, the poem could be like the outline for like a bigger, longer, extended thought. And so I loved poetry for the just because it's in the moment. It's in the, and there's also in the poetry readings, there is this kind of community and there's this warmth, and most, not every poet, but most of the poets are pretty thoughtful people, and everyone, you know, has a lot of love for each other. And afterwards we used to go to the dive bar, and we used to go to somebody's house for after hours. And there was a little scene about it. And then eventually we all got married, et cetera. But, you know, I'll tell you, there was a time in our 20s where we really had a lot of fun running around the city doing poetry.
Okay. Excellent. Wow. There's so many things in there that I want to dive into. Let's stop on that point about the immediacy, because someone like myself who writes essays, it's not as long as a book, but you know, there's a lot of trying to figure out, okay, how's the reader going to receive this? You know, how's this going to play out over time as it's published on this, whatever XYZ publication. Mm-hmm. And that does resonate with me, because I think personally as a writer, one of the things I feel like I'm always lacking is feedback from other writers, like other people who think about writing the way I do, or who are as engaged and as passionate about it as I am. So that's very interesting, that the aspect of poetry, the immediacy of poetry compared to the essays. What kind of essays were you writing early on? You said it was record reviews, but you also seemed like you were capturing some of the local stories.
And I mean, I was already starting to write neighborhood essays, and I've written a lot of neighborhood profiles. Okay. And like, there was a couple of essays I wrote as an undergrad at UCLA. Like, I had read City of Chords by Mike Davis 3-4 times by the time I'd already studied with him. Like, wow. I had a Los Angeles history class my second year at UCLA, and that class was a joy, and that class was really one of my favorite classes I ever took. And it might have even been my freshman year. I forget now, but that was one of the first classes that I really totally excelled at. And then I took a couple of urban planning classes at the end of my undergrad. And one time I wrote a book review for Mike Davis's City of Courts in this Marxist sociology class. And the professor was like, hey, you know, you did a really nice job on this. And this was a semester, this was the quarter before I ended up studying with Mike Davis. But that essay was an essay I remember at the time I was I was just learning, getting into John Coltrane, and I was playing some John Coltrane and staying late at night writing. And it was like a, I felt like I was doing what I was supposed to be doing. So that was one moment. Okay. And then in the urban planning class, they wanted us to write a neighborhood profile. And at the time I was living in the Sawtelle area of West Los Angeles, which is kind of a little Osaka. It's not little Tokyo, but there's a heavy Japanese neighborhood there. But there's also a big Latino neighborhood. And my buddies and I had this really cool little apartment in West LA. And we all, it was affordable back then. We had a three bedroom from 1200. So we were all paying $400 a month each.
Okay. And
I mean, this was not 96, 97, but we lived down the street from all these cool little places to get tempura, and you could get a cool big burrito. And then there was this coffee house called Lulu's Alibi, and you'd go write poems there. And, you know, and so I wrote this essay about that part of West Los Angeles. It was just west of the 405 freeway. There's the New Art Movie Theater there, which was like a cool little indie movie theater. And so I had a lot of fun writing about that neighborhood. And then down the street, there was a spot called Cafe Muse at Olympic and Sawtelle, which was the first open mic that I hosted myself. And and so as I really connected to this neighborhood, I was always connecting to different neighborhoods. And I started loving all these neighborhoods. So I started writing a lot of essays, and I look back at some of those essays, and they have youthful energy. I mean, they're not super polished or anything, and sometimes I kind of look at them and I'm like, oh man, I was this young and romantic. I mean, it had a lot of energy, but there wasn't, you know. But some of them were pretty, you know. There's aspects of them that are pretty good, and I try to remember the enthusiasm that I had back then, you know. And later on, I got more structured. Later on, I went to grad school, et cetera. But I remember when I was declined for the urban planning graduate program at the time, I had just had two poems published in the UCLA Urban Planning Journal, a journal called Critical Planning.
Okay.
And one of the women who was one of the major professors there and who liked my poems said to me, it might be a blessing that you were declined, because she's like, you're having so much fun with these poems, and you're really free, and maybe do that for a while. And she wasn't trying to discourage me, but she was saying, you know, maybe, you know. And I have a buddy of mine who's an urban planner now, who's a great guy, Jonathan Bell. But Jonathan's always telling me, man, there's so much policy, and every time you try to do something progressive, some developer bribes the city, or there's, you know, you're trying to do something progressive, but there's so much negotiating going on that nothing ever really happens. And so, you know, as the years went on, I realized that to be able to write about these neighborhoods, to write poems about these neighborhoods, maybe that was more my purpose anyway. And so I used to tell people I was an underground urban planner.
Oh, okay. Let's stay on that point, because as you may be aware, a lot of the listeners to this podcast are architects, designers, people in that kind of architecture space. And I find this really interesting that you had this interest in urban planning. I guess we could call it maybe the kind of this technical trade, but you had this expression through writing that you were pursuing. And it seems like in some ways how would I characterize that? You've still ended up very influentially engaging in the urban realm and in the urban domain, but in capturing stories and expressing qualities and aspects that perhaps a building, just designing a building and being done with it, wouldn't help someone to kind of see or to highlight. I guess what I'm trying to get at is, have you found that there is a role in, or what might you see your role as in the city, as a poet?
Thank you for that question. You know, I think in some ways I'm a kind of an instigator and a catalyst. And at Woodbury, where I teach, I have a lot of the architecture students in my class. Okay. And one of the things, I've had several of them tell me that they never liked poetry until they had my class, but I've had them write little haikus about a city journey, or we went to the mural of the Great Wall of Los Angeles, and I asked them to write, or we went to the Burbank City Hall, which is a really cool old Art Deco building. And so sometimes when I'm having the students do these short writing assignments, I think one of my roles is to maybe have people stop and look around and appreciate the city. And if you love LA, you're going to protect LA.
Nice. Yeah.
If you love the San Fernando Valley, you're going to, you know, I always tell students, if you know about the Verdugo Mountains, if you know about the Santa Ana winds, if you know about the Los Angeles River, you're going to be a better architect. But not only that, you're going to be a better citizen. And so I think there's this geographer I really like a lot named Obi Kaufman, who's written a book called The California Field Atlas. And there's hardly a guy I know who combines art and science so well, because he knows his science, he knows his geography, but he's this artist and he does these hand-painted maps. He's a cartographer, but he's also a painter. And Obi Kaufman talks about this idea called geographic literacy, and it really resonates. I was interested in geographic literacy before I'd ever heard him say that term. But when he said that term, it really resonated with me. And so one of my roles, I think, is to remind people to appreciate the Verdugo Mountains, to appreciate Mount Baldy.
And we don't
all have to become geographic experts. But as this poet Wendell Berry says, if you don't know where you are, you don't know who you are. So by knowing the local geography, appreciating your landscape, you're going to be a better citizen, and you might even have more fun with your kids on Sunday. You know, like, hey, let's go out to – my daughter and I have been doing this lately. We went to Monrovia and Myrtle Avenue. Monrovia is this really cool kind of underrated neighborhood, and then we went to Uptown Whittier the weekend before that, and there's all these cool little stores on Greenleaf, and amazing. We went to Lake Hollywood, or I've taken her to Balboa Park, Lake Balboa, and where Sherman Oaks and Van Nuys and Encino kind of intersect. And so I'm trying to get my. We were in San Francisco last weekend, and we went to the top of Twin Peaks, and we drove across the Golden Gate Bridge, but we had some great ramen in Japantown, and so to kind of make the city your oyster. But as you do that, you'll be a better architect, you know, you'll be a better engineer, and to really inhabit the landscape with investing yourself in it. And it's funny what Obi Kaufman talks about with his geographic literacy. He says that's his path to sustainability. He says that everybody knows global warming and climate change are happening. And he says, rather than scare the heck out of everybody, and he says, and rightfully we should be scared. He's not denying that, but his path is like he loves the redwood trees, so he'll paint redwood or he'll paint Mount Shasta, and then he'll have this map of where the Cascades meet the Sierra Nevada and the Sacramento River and the American River. And Obi Kaufman's idea is if we can, and so when he wrote that in his book, I love nature too, but I've lived my entire life in LA County, so I'm doing an LA County analogous to what he's trying to do with the landscape of throughout California. But I think through the poetry, through the essays I write, and I've been a tour guide for 25 years. I don't do it a whole lot anymore, but I worked for Redline Tours for 10 years. And even when I was teaching 3 days a week, I was still doing some tours for them on the weekends. And I've done tours for the Museum of Neon Art and Architecture and Design and the Craft and Folk Art Museum, and even for MTA Metro a few times. And so the tour guiding thing it initially started in my 20s when I just needed some freelance work.
Okay.
But so I think one of my roles is to celebrate the city, but I mean, I can still be critical too. I'm not entirely all booster.
Right. Yeah.
But I'm the lover. More than anything, I do love the city, but in order to critique something, you got to love something first to really be able to critique it right anyway.
Yeah. Okay, so a lot of things there, and to your point, even someone like me who's grown up not deep in the city, but who's grown up in LA County, I guess you could say, reading your book Letters to My City, and I'm gonna put a link in our show notes so everyone can go get the book and everyone go buy the book. but reading the poems especially, I were drawn to. It's interesting, and I want to ask you about knowledge, but reading like LA from A to Z, obviously as a writer, like I just appreciate the technical aspect of that, but also there is a certain knowledge that I feel like is coming through when I'm reading that, a certain like cities and places I just had never heard of going through that, this literary mode of expression, talking about specifically LA. And then obviously I'm alive in Los Angeles. I really loved, there's a clip I found of you. Man, I should have had it up, but of you performing on your Instagram. And then a colleague of yours, I kind of took it off. He was in the crowd, and he kind of
Best Kept, Corey Kofor, aka Best Kept, one of my best friends, fantastic guy.
Yeah.
He's a poet.
Yeah, and there's so
new teacher.
Yeah, and so as I'm reading these things, because I've been trying to get more familiar with or more engage more with poetry, and being in downtown on a weekly basis now, working in downtown, I'm just like, okay, I feel like there's an aspect or a spirit of the city that I'm getting through reading Mike's poems that, you know, is different than if I looked at a map or if I read a kind of historical analysis, which is useful too, but there's a deeper, a different form of knowledge, I feel like, that's being accessed in the poetry. And what I'm getting at is, you said, if we don't know where we are, we don't know who we are, which is also a line from the narrator in Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, one of my favorite novels.
I love that novel. Yeah, I need to reread it. I read it 20 years back, but I love that novel.
And he kind of has that line in there as well. And I wanted to ask you if you feel that writing or the act of writing has a role to play in understanding where we are in knowledge. And yeah.
That's a great question, Sean. Thank you. You know, when I was at UCLA, I used to sit on Bruin Walk and just people watch and write about people walking by. And I'll say there was a lot of time in my 20s where I used to be at little coffee houses and on Larchmont and on Franklin and on Abbot Kinney and in different neighborhoods of the city. But then some of the poems, I'm really on that kind of the truth is stranger than fiction type thing. So a lot of my poems, these different little individual lines are from real experiences or you know, I Am Alive in Los Angeles poem, and then there's a sequel, I Am Still Alive in Los Angeles. And then in the original I Am Alive in Los Angeles, there's a line that says, I saw a stray dog that looked like Spuds McKenzie by the Belmont Tunnel on 2nd Street, live and direct in the Rampart District, and I'm alive in Los Angeles. And I remember I was driving home, you know, really one late night, and I saw a stray dog that looked like Spuds McKenzie, you know, on the Belmont by the Belmont Tunnel on 2nd Street. So little interesting things, you know, the Catholic school kids crossing fearlessly, and you know, and so a lot of my poems were these very observational, direct experience. And William Carlos Williams had been an influence on me on that, because he had a thing called Poetry of the Local, and William Carlos Williams was a doctor and delivered hundreds and hundreds of babies. But by the time he was in his 50s, he was also one of America's most famous poets. Okay. But his poetry career was just a real gradual thing. But he would like write poems in between patients, and he would write poems about, you know, he would just look out a window and write a poem. And so when I learned about William Carlos Williams, it was around the same time I was learning Mike Davis and Juana Coleman and Allen Ginsberg, and that was the Beat Generation, the Harlem Renaissance, Langston Hughes. There was all these things that were kind of coalescing together. And I liked Langston Hughes's just direct language, but he could make something very direct, still very beautiful. And and also early Walt Whitman and to be honest, early 90s hip hop, you know, even Common's second record Resurrection, you know, early 90s hip hop, Walt Whitman had these big list poems, you know, I Sing the Body Electric. And so the I'm Alive in Los Angeles was sort of Walt Whitman and early 90s hip hop and kind of this intersection of all these things. But as far as knowledge from that, I got a lot of that knowledge from pounding the pavement. Like I had jobs in a lot of neighborhoods. I had good friends that lived in different neighborhoods. I used to, you know, drive around the city and be like, oh, my ex-girl lived over there, or, you know, my grandfather worked here. And so a lot of it was this experiential knowledge.
Right. Yeah. And I think to go deeper on that a bit, what I'm getting at is, what am I saying here? Like there could be another Mike in another parallel universe who has those experiences, but who doesn't write them down. And I think I'm getting at what is the value of the writing, or the value, does that bring, is that to a act of service to the readers, you know, to, you know, why go through, obviously you're an artist and there's the yearning of you have to, I'm sure it's like you have to write it, but the greater contribution to culture through the writing, is what I'm trying to get at, or trying to perhaps,
you know, that's a great question. You know, in some ways, as you know, the only thing constant is change. So the city is always changing, you know, and some landmark today might be gone tomorrow. And so some of the writing down of the is about recording the moment. And I'm a journalist too. So I've been a journal and I've been always writing in my journal. So some of the poems, it's kind of comes back to the immediate again.
Gotcha.
And a lot of like, there's a poem I've written about the LA River, and I used to spend a lot of time out on the LA River, and I knew the founder of the Friends of Los Angeles River, Lewis McAdams. And so a lot of the poems, you know, there were some poems that were written for explicitly for tours that I was giving.
Okay.
Like, there's a poem that's not in Letters to My City, but it'll probably be in a future book. But I was giving a neighborhood tour of Eagle Rock, and I had a poem about Eagle Rock. And I used to write poems about – I spent a lot of time in Venice. This will be in my next poetry book. There's a poem I'd written about Venice, and I did some history tours of Venice, and I used to do a lot of poetry. I still do at a spot called Beyond Baroque in Venice. Okay. And so some of the poems were written in service of things, and – I have a poem called The Oral Tradition, which is sort of a history of spoken word poetry and kind of how poetry was initially an oral art form. And I had originally wrote that poem because I was teaching AP English at the time, and I wanted to show my students that all these poetry movements are connected. So some of the time when I was writing poems, there was even a little bit of a didactic purpose for it.
Okay.
And the poems there's like, I wrote a 10,000 word essay about the history of spoken word, but then I also wrote a 400 word poem about the history of spoken word.
Okay.
And so there's this great quote by Yeats that, you know, when you write a poem, you're having an argument with yourself. When you're writing an essay, you're having an argument with the world.
Oh, okay. I haven't heard that. I like
so
that.
There's been a lot of there's been a lot of topics that I've written both poems and essays about, and the poem might be a little bit like a cliff notes, a quicker, like little snapshot. And so, but some of it is, you're right about the cathartic thing, but then as far as in service of the people, maybe it's like a little cheat sheet or, you know, and I've learned that we're all contributing to a bigger conversation. The conversation is going on, and it will go on when we're all long gone. It'll be, the conversation just keeps building. And I think a lot, sometimes I use sports metaphors, but I loved Michael Jordan, but you know, everybody said Michael Jordan was inspired by Dr. J. And Dr. J was inspired by Oscar Robertson. And there's always these, you know, Michael Jackson was incredible, but he was inspired by James Brown.
Right,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And
there's this,
Jimi Hendrix redefined the guitar, and then Eddie Van Halen tried to do his thing, you know? And so I know that I have a certain role. I was inspired a lot by Jack Kerouac and Mike Davis. Yeah. And as I said, Langston Hughes. But I was coming up in the time of hip hop and punk rock. And so I remember Nirvana was huge my senior year of high school. And we were into both hip hop and grunge and punk. And I mean, I was even into the Smiths, and I was into nice. Morrissey. And I remember, you know, Morrissey, the first time I ever heard about Keats and Yeats and Oscar Wilde was from songs in Morrissey. And then later on, I studied these different poets but so I think the poetry, not to repeat myself, but it's maybe a gateway. It's a gateway to a larger conversation.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, no, that's fair. And into the journalism aspect. And I didn't have a list because I'm like, I know I'm going to miss something that Mike has contributed to, but I know LA Taco has been you've been a huge contributor to LA Taco, KCET. I know you've been doing some writing for Alta Journal, which has been great. At Metropolis, and I'm sure I'm missing a bunch over your long career. And that's where these essays are coming in. I want to get into. Because in all of these, you're telling stories about the people in these places, but in some ways, I guess that's essentially the story of the place, right? The stories of the people is the story of the place, of these places.
Yeah, and you know, have you ever read John Dos Passos?
No, I have not.
He was that 20s novelist, and he had these little mini biographies in his fiction, and he really chronicled the 1920s really well. And I need to even read more of him. But also Ronald Takaki, he's the historian, Japanese American historian, and he was kind of an Asian American Howard Zinn, if you will, and kind of like a Mike Davis. But Ronald Takaki talked about this idea that was originally from C. Wright Mills called the sociological imagination.
Okay.
And then sort of this intersection of history and biography.
Okay. I like this. Yeah.
And so when I'm talking about, for example, some of the most recent essays I wrote about the muralist Man One, who started off as a graffiti artist, but now he's this great public artist and doing all these murals for different cities. And then I wrote about this Japanese American poet named Amy Umatsu, who's in her 70s now, but she was in, she's published 6 books, and she was in the, her professor at UCLA, and she was in the first class of Asian American studies at UCLA in the early 1970s. And her professor at the time was even the person who coined the term Asian American.
Oh, wow.
And so Amy Umatsu, her grandfather, was an influential nursery and flower farmer. He had a really big nursery in Montebello. And Montebello was a city of a bunch of flower farms, but he was placed into the internment camps. But before he went into the internment camps, her grandfather had imported the camellia flower from Japan. And the camellia flower is this beautiful flower that blooms in the winter.
Okay.
And so it's sort of the symbol of resilience. But her grandfather sold 300,000 camellia flowers to the founders of Descanso Gardens. That guy, the founder of Descanso Gardens, bought the flowers from him at a really discounted rate because he was about to be sent into Manzanar. But while I'm telling the story of Amy Umatsu and her pioneering role as an Asian American poet, there's also this story about her grandfather in the internment camps and her coming of age in Pasadena in the 60s and going to UCLA and her experiencing racism and how a lot of her poems were a response to racism. And then somebody saying something, "Oh, you speak English really well." And she's like, "Yeah, I was born here, dumbass." But in between her great life story and talking about her great poetry books, because I'm a big fan of her poetry, but she's also lived this really interesting life. And my buddy Man One, he was a big fan of the muralist David Alfaro Siqueiros, and he realized that murals could unify people. And so he started doing these public art projects for different cities. And then now he has a really great career. He just did the former Jordan Downs housing project in Watts is now being renamed Cedar Grove.
Okay.
But he's doing 25 to 30 portrait murals of longtime residents there.
Oh, amazing. Amazing.
And those portrait murals are to celebrate the longtime residents. And they're about kind of a self-determination and to make people proud of their neighborhoods. And so murals can be this unifying force. And so while I'm writing about this great artist, I'm also talking about how public art is a source of pride for people. And so I like within the realm of telling somebody's individual story, you can tell a heck of a lot of great history too, all at the same time.
That's beautiful. I definitely want to leave links to these. Are these in Alta Journal, these recent essays?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Those two that I mentioned were in Alta. But I mean, I really cut my teeth writing those types of essays for KCET.
Okay.
And written for KCET for 11 years. And there's like over 230 articles of mine on their site. Like for 4 years, I had a weekly column. Okay. And then I started teaching high school again. I've taught high school for 6 years. I don't teach high school anymore. I haven't taught high school in about 6 years now, and I've taught college for coming up on 9 years now. So wow. I've been teaching for 15 years, but I used to do a weekly column and then I went to more of a monthly. Okay. But I never go more than a month or two without publishing an essay, but you're a father too, so you get it. Yeah. So I'm juggling parenthood and freelance writing and teaching, but I love to write these essays.
Yeah, they're you know, I haven't been able to read all of them, because all of the hundreds of them, but the ones that you have sent me and that I have read, I even in some of my own work, and I know I think we connected from that essay.
I love that piece you did about that gallery. That's when I was like, this guy's a great writer and he's a cool guy. I saw you were at Woodbury at the time and I saw that piece. And then I think we initially met, maybe even walking through the halls at Woodbury. But when you did that piece about the gallery and how this man with his gallery was trying to contribute to his neighborhood, I that story really resonated with me because those are some of my favorite stories.
Yeah, yeah, and that's exactly what I was and thank you, Mike. I appreciate it. And that is how we met, by the way. Yeah, I remember walking up toward to Woody's. And,
yeah.
And then some guy was like, Sean, hey, Sean. And I was like, who is this guy? And it was you. And I went over there and I was like, because I think you had commented on a few of my pieces that I had posting.
Yeah, I enjoyed that piece, man. I was like, I got to talk to this guy.
Yeah, yeah. And I was like, oh, this is Mike. Because I see Mike on the little avatar online. And I was like, oh, this is Mike. And then we rest is history with us. But exactly what you're saying is like that totally resonates with me too, because I'm still very much working on trying to do that. And I love biographies like that. That's how I, almost everything I learn about history is through biography. You know, I just finished a biography on Teddy Roosevelt, which was awesome. And I learned a ton about that era of just American history and everything going on and all of these other things.
The Philippines and
Yeah. And I remember reading a book, Brunelleschi's Dome by Ross King.
Oh, wow.
And it's a book about the Florence Cathedral over in Florence, Italy. And Filippo Brunelleschi, who was the kind of pioneer who designed the dome. And the way the book was written was it was about this piece of architecture, the cathedral, but it was really this like saga, this drama of like all of the, like the politics in the city, about Brunelleschi himself and how he worked out all of these issues and how to build the thing. And then the clashes he had with the other workmen on the site and all these different things. And looking at that, I'm like, this is a design. This is an architectural story, or this is a story that I would want to read that goes beyond just, you know, and the cladding with stone and, you know, or like some of these things we might read and that goes beyond just like critical theory or just theory in general, which a lot of architectural writing, you know, having gone to architecture school, a lot of the things we read is theory, which is fine. But there's this aspect to narrative that you're talking about that I still think touches on those profound ideas and things, but having it centered around people, like the story you just told about this Japanese woman and her dad selling the, like, I'm like, I didn't even know that. And you just giving me a summary. I'm like, this is fascinating, you know, and I've been to Descanso Gardens and, you know, and so there's a greater depth than if someone just told me, or if I just read a plaque while I was there that said, you know.
Yeah. As cool as the little plaques are, that deeper story is so awesome. It's so much better and it fills in a lot of space.
Agreed. So let's get into your teaching a bit. Cause I think the kind of main aspects I wanted to chat with you about, and I think would be of value to listeners, is obviously the writing. I think we're exploring that a bit. And then I want to talk about the kind of craft of the tour guide, like, but then also teaching, like how, like, tell me a bit more about what you teach at Woodbury, and yeah, how you've been going about that.
Well, I'm now, it's just in the last 4 years, I first started at Woodbury 8 years ago, but in the last 4 years, I've become the coordinator of the first year experience program.
Oh, wonderful. Congrats.
And that's awesome. Shout out to Ruben Ellis. He's a fantastic dean, and Ruben is going to be retiring shortly, and I'm really going to miss him because he's just a wonderful dude. But Ruben liked the way that I was doing these poetry open mics, and he liked the way that I was, because I was a former high school teacher, that I was connecting with these first-year students and helping them get acclimated to college.
Okay.
So one of the classes I teach is PASS 100, the Pathway to Student Success. And that class is really like welcome to college. And it's a little bit of 101 of academic writing, but it's also even just doing things like having them writing a cover letter to their dream job.
Okay.
Or write a timeline of your life and just these little things that help them, to be honest with you, just get their identity, to reflect on their lives, reflect on their family. But I also give them – I talk to them a lot about my own writing experience, and I'm really – trying to make them better communicators and even teaching them some of the protocol of the academic world and how to navigate it. So that's a class that I've taught 5 or 6 times. And I really like that class because, I mean, I try to even say some things that maybe not everybody talks to them about. Like I tell them that relationships are what matter almost more than anything, and that emotional intelligence and to know how to navigate navigate the pathways of even student teacher relations or how to, you know, send an email properly, and some things that you almost take for granted, but not everybody knows that. And common sense always isn't necessarily always that common.
Right. I like that. Yeah. Right.
But then I've also taught poetry workshops many times and creative writing. And then I teach the 100 level INDS classes, journeys, knowledges, conflicts, and natures. And those classes are 101, 102, 103, 104, INDS, 101, you know, and interdisciplinary studies. And they are sort of a combination of a little English, a little history, a little sociology, a little cultural studies, even a little bit of theory, a little bit of urbanism in them. I've also taught a class called LA Stories a few times, which is a mixture of LA fiction and film and a little bit of LA poetry, a little bit of LA music. And by the way, everything I teach always has some LA in it. You know, we're always going to have a little bit. Right now, I'm having students do a project in the knowledges class called Geographic Literacy. Okay. And in the Geographic Literacy, I've asked them to draw a map of their neighborhood. And if they're not from LA, that's fine. Wherever they're from, to draw a map of where they grew up.
Okay.
And then to place five sacred points on that map. It could be the restaurant that your family always ate at. It could be your church. It could be the park you used to play soccer at. It could be the library you grew up studying in. But then I asked them to do a short, not just 2-3 page essay about that map that they're drawing.
Okay.
But I want them to connect to where they're from. And so a lot of my teaching, I wouldn't be a teacher if I hadn't been a guest speaker as a poet first. All five of my best teaching jobs were places that I was a guest speaker at first.
I see. And you have somebody, you go in there and speak and it resonates with like a faculty and they come and approach you kind of, hey, Mike, you know, we'd love to have more of this.
That's kind of what's happened. Yeah. And I mean, I never planned. My mom retired from almost 40 years of teaching and she taught for a long time in Long Beach Unified School District. And when I was 23, she wanted me to be a teacher. And I was like, I'm a poet. I want to write, you know, but
right.
And in my early 30s, I started going to I was doing tours and people would be on my tour and I'm Alive in Los Angeles on the tour or something. And they'd be like, hey, can you come over here and come to our high school and do a workshop at our high school? And so I would go and then I would host an open mic with the students, or I'd have them write their own little LA poem or something. And I actually was a guest speaker at Woodbury in 2006. Okay. And then they had me as a guest speaker 5-6 years in a row. And then in 2014, Will McConnell said, hey, do you want to pick up these two classes?
Nice.
But I love teaching, and it's something that sort of just happened organically. And I've also slowly figured out how to make the teaching work with my writing.
Okay.
And that's can be a challenge sometimes because there's a lot of grading and there's department meetings and all these things.
Amazing. I mean, almost all of these questions are my own selfish interest too, that, you know, to learn from you. Cause I taught a contemporary issues class in the architecture department. And I think I shared a bit with you what I was trying to do. And I was
it sounded really good.
Yeah. I was trying to do some writing and, you know, experimenting with some things. But just your point on the grading, that was tough. Cause I'm just like, okay, if I make these things too long, I have to read all of them. And I want, you know, I need to give each student the same level of attention and care.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that really informed like the length of even the assignments of like, you know, what is my bandwidth to give proper feedback.
I
wanted to ask you if you, because I've had, oh, and this is the other note I wanted to make, is I have had some students in architecture mention your class and mention their interest in writing and talk about, yeah, you know, Mike's class, or I always hear reference like, yeah, Mike's class, or I'm working talking about writing with Mike and, you know, this. So just to echo that impact on the design students and obviously the rest of the students in the university. And I wanted to ask you if you do see a change from when a student walks in and you've gotten them to start articulating things through writing, maybe reading, writing, if you see any kind of transformation or ever hear from students or seeing, yeah, a kind of transformation in the student from day one to like end of semester when they've actually written something. Some of them, I imagine, never even done any of this before in their lives.
Yeah. You know, and I mean, I even, a few times in the past, I had, you know, a guy who was maybe more of a number crunch, maybe more of a math and science guy, or somebody who maybe, you know, even for lack of a better word, maybe never knew how to feel. You know what I mean?
Okay.
You know,
right,
and I've had some, you know, people be like, most of them are with it, but I've had students be a little resistant sometimes, like, oh, I'm not sure what to say. And I'm like, well, you know what? I start most classes with what I call a quick write. It's okay. About 8 to 10 minutes of a either responding to a quote or maybe it's something we're reading in the class, or sometimes it's even a question like, what are three things you got to work on this week?
Okay.
Or, you know, like I have them doing like, and so I've had some students, you know, initially, but the idea is for me, it's about repetition. The more you write, the better you're going to get. And so, one of my mentors once told me, she said, you know what, if you have them writing every class, and some of this was coming out of all these poetry workshops I used to be in, We would all write a poem and then hear each other. And so I'm like, okay, I tell them at the end of the semester, they turn in a portfolio of 12 pieces of writing. But I tell them that if there's 14, 15 week semester, we're going to meet 28 times, maybe 30 times, depending on how many holidays are that month. Mm-hmm. But if we write every single class and you're only turning in 12 pieces to me, most of the stuff you write, I won't even read. Not that I don't want to read it, but you know, it's for you to just get better and better and better and better and better.
Right.
And then I've had some of them say, hey, you know what? I'm starting to really understand the value of this. And a lot of it is just to become a better communicator.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, that note that you said about knowing how to feel too, could you expand on that a bit more? I think there's a lot in there in that, just that short statement.
Yeah. You know, I mean, emotional intelligence is a major thing these days. And I mean, it's been a major thing forever, actually. Yeah. But I think this is something I've been thinking a lot about. And I talk to my wife about this a lot, too. In the grind, and whether or not I like it, you know, we all do have to grind. You know, like I have my kids, and so sometimes in the grind, you almost don't even have time to feel. But yeah. I think if you can connect to yourself, like, you can be more complete. And I mean, some of it, I've been reading a lot of Carl Jung over the last few years, of it was from parenting, and I was going through a lot of different things myself. Okay. And so some of it is to try to connect the heart and the mind, because we're all up in our heads so much. I mean, and I'm super cerebral guy, overthinker. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And to be a little bit personal, I've told the students this stuff. When my son was born, there was one year I was teaching at three colleges. One of them, I was teaching at Woodbury, Southwest, and Cal State LA.
Wow.
And I was still doing some tours, and my son had just been born. My daughter was 4, but there was all of these things that were happening at once. And at times I felt over my head in things. And so I was always journaling anyway, but I doubled down on my journaling practice. There was one year in my life that I performed the least poetry. I said no. I didn't used to say no to gigs, but then I started saying no to some gigs. And so I took some time to really consolidate. And I think it really helped my teaching. It helped my marriage, because I think there was a time to be a little bit personal where maybe I said yes to too many things and I didn't know how to draw boundaries. Yeah. And so I don't tell my whole life story to the students, but I do tell them that, hey, all of these little writing assignments I'm having you do, I've done a lot of them myself, and it was what I needed to do to get my own head together. And as I started journaling more, and I mean, as I started being more intentional with it, I always journaled, but as I was intentional, like, okay, I got to do these 5 things this week and send these emails. And so it helps them process their feelings. And I think, and then we do an open mic in class, and some people really share and some people don't, and that's fine. I don't make people share. But what I have found is when somebody really shares, usually a few people in the room resonate with it. And there's a student, actually, I saw him just the other day. His name is Miguel Chavez, okay. And he was my student 8 years ago, my first class at Woodbury. But he's an actor now and a screenwriter.
Oh,
and
he's amazing.
He's like 30, you know, but I met him when he was 22. And great guy. But he told me that my class was a breakthrough for him because he'd only done academic writing and he didn't know that he could be creative. And so I had them do the very popular assignment called Where I'm From, it's sort of an earlier version of the geographic literacy, but the Where I'm From is where you just write about your home you grew up in.
Okay.
But he wrote this really cool thing about being mixed race. His mother is Korean, his father's Mexican, and he wrote this thing about this intersection of these two cultures.
Oh, very cool.
But that how music and comedy, and now he's an actor, and how music and comedy helped him find his identity, but then the different foods. And he read the piece in front of the class. This was in 2015, and everybody loved the piece. And I was like, dude, you're talented, bro, and you nice job.
Yeah.
And then he told me the other day, we hadn't seen each other in about 4 or 5 years. He said, you know, man, I want to thank you because that was a transformative moment. And the vote of confidence you gave in me made me start taking more chances. And so maybe sometimes I just give students permission. I mean, they're already awesome. They're awesome before me, and they're going to do it anyway. But I still like to be the guy to give them a pound and be like, all right, keep going.
That's awesome. Thank you for sharing all that, Mike, your own personal stuff, and then just the anecdote with the journaling. And it's and I'm happy you brought that up because I did have this on these list of themes I want to talk about is the role and the power of journaling. And I totally resonate with everything you were saying about parenting, busyness, because I too am someone where, you know, I have to gauge and balance. Like, I would love to just say yes to every publication opportunity, every essay.
Yes.
But I'm like, okay,
yes.
You know, how much am I going to have to travel? Am I going to have to go interview these people? And then when I get home, and I have to listen to those interviews, review these notes, and you know, all these things. And then on top of that, you know, there's this other great opportunity that I would love to write. Am I going to say yes to that too? And then that means I'm saying no to my sons, no to my wife, and all these things.
I
think that's what I was wanting us to get to for the listeners is that just the simple act of journaling can just be tremendously powerful. And for me, that helped me to kind of make sense of like, what is, when I look back on this time, this moment, am I going to be happy that I wrote like one extra essay, or am I going to be happy that I like, you know, every Saturday I stuck to my time to be at the park and play with my kids, you know, and, you know, or is this essay just why am I even writing this? Is it because I want to just have an essay out there, or do I need to work on a longer piece that's going to delay the gratification of getting of recognition? And you know, all these different things but the act of journaling, man. I get to work and wrestle with myself and work through those things and come to like, what am I really trying to do here? But yeah, I'd love you to build on that.
Sean, you know what, everything you just spoke about in this moment, I'm thinking a heck of a lot about, because I have taken on those extra essays many times, and then I've only lately, you know, in the last few years, gotten better at saying no sometimes. But there were different publications that pay better, and then I mean, I still even occasionally do free ones. Not a whole lot of free stuff because I'm too busy as a dad, but I'll even, you know, in a certain moment at a certain time. But yeah, like those essays are hard work, and it's a lonely. You're alone late night, and
right.
Your wife and son are asleep, you know, you and the screen, man, and maybe you're having a sip of tea, or maybe you had a quick midnight snack or something. But I used to do a lot of that late night writing, and now it's more like in the afternoons, and now it's here and there and kind of sprinkled in throughout things. And sometimes it's even 15, 20, 30 minutes at a time, you know, even just paragraph by paragraph. But I am trying, like I was an assistant coach of my son's soccer team last year, and The guy who was the head coach was the real coach. I was just more like the high five specialist, you know what I mean? But like, but that was a fulfilling experience. Like my son and I were at every practice and at every game. Yeah. And so I'm doing my best to do all of that. And as I said, my Sundays with my daughter and I taking a drive on Sunday to places.
Yeah.
And, I'm trying to be more mindful about what I say yes to. And you know, you do sometimes got to say no. And somebody recently asked me to do one thing, and it was something that was going to be a lot of work, and there wasn't really any pay in it. And I was like, man, I can't do that one.
Yeah.
It's just too labor intensive.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. The pay thing is an interesting one too, because there's, it's just, I do think I'm thinking of the listeners now, and I'm thinking of a few people that I know are interested in this writing path or interested in writing, and so I think we're going down a road that could be helpful to people who have full time jobs and things like that. But for me, the pay thing has come into play, because when I was just starting out, I didn't care. I'm just like, you're going to publish it, like, you know, I gotta show. Like, I do think that there's a reality of like, I have to show editors and readers like what my ability, like what I can do. There's an aspect of that. And now that that's happened to a degree, there are opportunities that are much better paying opportunities. And so now for me, I feel like, okay, I think that there's justification on my time, and I know what someone will pay me for my time. And so the sacrifice that I inevitably have to make as a artist, writer, or a writer who has a family, has a full-time job and has these things, I have to make the call of like, okay, you're going to pay me, you know, I can't take $300 for a 1200 word essay now, like, mm-hmm. because this, mm-hmm. this publication paid me $1 a word, you know?
Yeah, man. For
that. And so, but then I'm like, okay, well, maybe this one that's paying me cheaper is going to let me go down this path or down this rabbit hole that I want to go down, and they're not going to over edit me, and they're going to let me be a little mm-hmm. bit more expressive. So that has value to me because I can really, they're going to take a chance on me or not kind of be in my weeds too much. And I have a network of people that can really help me get this thing pretty solid, and I want this to be out there. And so, yeah, the less your pay is worth it, you know? And so there's these, man, those kinds of things that.
That is a really great point, because there's a couple publications I write for. There was one that, that they barely edit me at all. And they're really pump hard on the social media. You mm-hmm. know what I mean? And so, like, they really get it out there. And then there's another one that would pay a little bit better, but they really edit you down to the bone, you know, yeah. and you're going back and forth. And I mean, I remember times, I don't mind the back and forth, but sometimes, you know, you're just like, enough back and forth, just let's go. And you're even okay with, like, if you want to cut that paragraph. But I mean, I remember one time, a long time ago, I had an editor, and it was like a 2,500 word piece, but they cut out almost 1,000 words wow. out of it. And then I had to tell them, you know what? I knew what my reader was into. And I was like, you know, some of that stuff that looks really like trivia, that's the information that lets the hardcore reader know that I've done my research. Mm-hmm. And it might seem minutia, but, right. but it's actually the little extra details that, and so there is a happy medium between that. And so I still sometimes write for some of the things that don't pay as much, because it's more of a labor of love.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to be a little bit more mindful of that, and I'll do it in a period where I have energy. Like, but when it's heavy in the semester and there's
right.
I'm grading midterms or finals, and then I got to pump out some other stuff, I might say no to that then.
Nice. Yeah. Very cool. So, yeah, it's interesting to just hear those different opportunities. And I'm still in this exploratory mode. Ever since I transitioned from full time at ArchConnect, where I was writing there. Now I've done something for Dwell Magazine. I've done something for Architects Newspaper, Architect Magazine, and I'm just kind of in this mode where I'm like, I want to just try out some different publications, just see what it's like. And I've definitely had more chemistry with some editors over others,
mm-hmm.
where I'm like, okay, mm-hmm. they get it. They understand what I'm trying to do, or maybe they're familiar with my other mm-hmm. writing. And then other ones where I'm like, man, this publication really has a way they wanted this thing to be. And like, I'm pushing myself to a point where I'm like, I don't even know if I even like this anymore. You know,
once or twice I pulled a piece.
Oh, did you?
Okay. Once or twice, there was one editor. He was great, but it was his superior that wasn't so cool.
Oh, gotcha.
And he and I were going back and forth for a couple of months on it. And then he leveled with me one day. Hey man, if you want to just take us somewhere else, go ahead.
Yeah.
So I took it somewhere else that was going to pay a little less, but they barely touched it. And then it was like published the next week.
Gotcha.
So
yeah, like quick. Yeah. Very cool. Well, I'm curious, Mike. What would you say to someone who is like, I want to write? Because I'll tell you the situation I get, and then perhaps you could respond to this. Is I'll have people call me, colleagues mostly, and say, Sean, I want to publish. I have this idea. How do I go about publishing this piece? And then I'll say, oh, like, can I see the piece, or have you written it? They'll be like, oh, I haven't written it yet. And then I'll usually say, well, you gotta write before you start thinking about even just the publishing, you know? And so sometimes it comes mm-hmm. to a conversation of like, well, you know, what is this really about? Do you want to write, or do you just want, you know, that saying mm-hmm. like a lot of writers want to have written, but they don't want to write, but they like having written, you know?
Yeah. You know what? You said an important point there. Like the thing about writing, and as you know, and as we were talking about, It can be a lonely pursuit, and there is no getting around the sitting down and doing it mm-hmm. and just doing it. And one of the greatest professors I ever had, Peter Sellers, who was at UCLA in the World Arts and Cultures Department, he said something that I've never forgotten. He said, all that time you spend thinking about something, you could have been doing it already.
Yeah.
have you ever read Peter Elbow?
No. I'm writing. Down, by the way,
Peter Elbow is a writing theorist.
Okay,
and he's I think he's probably still alive. He's in his 80s or, you know, but Peter Elbow was a big proponent of free writing. And he's not the only person who's free. There's been a few people that were big advocates of free writing, but Peter Elbow's idea, and it's sort of like the Anne Lamott, the shitty first drafts kind of thing, you know, but, I think you do just have to do that shotgun method of like, just purge, just let it all out. Yeah. Just write your heart out and get it out there. And then go ahead, come back and edit it later. But I think the joy and the romance and the passion is the starting point. Then you can go ahead and refine it and revise it and really fine tune it. But first things first, do get it out and spend a couple hours, maybe have a big cup of coffee or something, or you know, write on a morning where you got some energy or something. But there is no getting around just pumping it out. Yeah. And I mean, maybe you want to make an outline. I mean, I don't always make an outline for a piece, but maybe about half the time or two thirds of the time, I might, at least in my journal, do a one page sort of a brainstorm ramble or sketch. Exactly. Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I've been lately with essays. Sometimes the kind of structure will kind of come to me, or I'll kind of just like, man, I know what to say, and I'll just get going. With fiction, I'm definitely doing outlines more, or I'll have a scene, or I'll write a scene. But, you know, I'm getting in kind of some technical things here, but one of my larger challenges with fiction is plot. And so I'll find myself having to like, okay, I got to figure out where these things, cause I can think of a scene and I'll do the scene, and that I seem to be able to do well. But then when it's a longer narrative over time, then I'm just like, okay, the plot's getting lost, or like that intuitively for me, I'm still working on. So I'll find myself doing outlines for that kind of stuff.
You know, fiction is hard, and I've written very, very little of it, but I have a love of crime fiction.
Oh, okay. Well, what kind of stories?
This is a book I'm reading right now that's really interesting.
Small Time by Russell Shorto.
This guy was a historian and wrote a great book about early New York City when it was called New Amsterdam.
Okay.
But this dude, his grandfather was a mafia boss of a small Pennsylvania town.
Oh, wow.
And this dude left his house when he was 19 years old. His dad was not in the mob, but his grandfather was like the mob boss of this town called Johnstown in Pennsylvania.
Okay.
And when his grandfather died, this guy's cousin said to him, you know, you're this historian and has written these best-selling books. You better write about our family. You know about the – he sort of like loosely knew this. But so he spent several years interviewing his dad and interviewing all these people in the town that were still around. And I'm almost done. I'm on 190 right now. Oh, it's nice. 254. Nice. But this is actually nonfiction, but there's a lot of interesting things about the – it was over a 30, 40-year period about his family and the mob and that town. And
very interesting.
He even goes a tiny bit into the history of Sicily, because his family members had been in Sicily. His great-grandfather was from Sicily and came to Pennsylvania.
Oh, but wow.
I like reading Gary Phillips and Naomi Hirahara, and I mean, I like Elroy, and I like Mosley and Michael Connelly too. I like Susan Strait. She's not so much crime fiction, but fiction is a nice escape for me, because I'm reading a lot of nonfiction and poetry all the time. But I sneak in a lot of fiction here and there. It's just like a little recharge.
Nice. And crime is your. Is your
you know what's cool about the crime fiction is that there's a lot of LA history weaved in between. Like, I just read One Shot Harry by Gary Phillips, and Gary Phillips also had a protagonist named Ivan Monk.
Okay,
and so these crime fiction stories, there's a protagonist who's, you know, I guess, you know, Raymond Chandler and Dashiell Hammett and Kane and these guys were the progenitors of that. But and Chester Himes even did his thing with that too. You know, I like crime fiction is a lot of fun. And in between that, they'll say, you know, we were outside on a little shack at Washington Boulevard and
there's like a little LA. There, what would you recommend? Like I've read The Big Sleep by Raymond Chandler.
Mm-hmm.
If I wanted to read another cool LA crime novel, what would be your recommendation?
You know, Naomi Hirahara, has written a whole 7-book series about this Japanese American gardener who would solve crime. And the Big Bachi, B-A-C-H-I. Naomi Hirohara, she's written like 15, 20 books. So she's kind of half fiction, half nonfiction. Okay. She's a Japanese-American historian, but she said she would do all this historical research, and then she would write novels that would use some of that historical research, but she would create characters that would inhabit those landscapes.
You said the Big Bachi is one of the books?
Yeah. Okay. And she... Or like the Summer of the Big Bachi, I think. But Naomi Hirohara, her crime, and also Gary Phillips. Gary Phillips and Naomi Hirohara are published by the same people, and they're good friends too, and they're about the same age. Gary Phillips is the guy, man. His last book, One Shot Harry, and the sequel of it is about to come out.
Okay.
And I'm going to be doing a story on Gary Phillips. I've written about him a little bit here and there over the years, but I love Gary Phillips, and he's a real charismatic dude, but cool. He writes dialogue better than Tarantino.
Oh wow! Are you writing that piece for Alta again, or are you able to say? Or
you know, I haven't.
Are you kind of just going? I'm
not even sure.
Go ahead.
I'm not even sure yet who I'm going to write it for, but nowadays maybe as a dad, most of the time I try to secure who I'm going to write for it before I start it. But I'm old fashioned enough that a lot of times I just do the piece and I'm like, it's going to land somewhere.
That's what I do. I was going to ask you that because I get too much. Usually when I start, usually the act of writing the essay, I figure out what it's going to be. And so the few times where like someone's asked me to pitch things, I always get super anxious because I'm just like, it's going to be, I've always been historically so far in my writing career, which is still very young. I've always just written the piece and just showed it to the person. I just feel a lot more confident, like knowing I worked on this, knowing I've had really smart people help me and read it and help me edit it to just go and say, hey, you guys interested in this? And it's done. Rather than, hey, I'm going to write this thing. And they're like, okay, can you have it to us in 2 weeks? I'm just like, I guess. Yeah. You know, and then there's the pressure of doing that.
But I'm with you, and I would say 85-90% of the time I've done just what you're saying. I would write the piece first.
Gotcha.
It's only been in the last few years, because I've been around so long now, that I have people reach out to me and commission me to do things. Like for KCT in the last 4 or 5 years, depending on the year, but I would average maybe some years more than others, but sometimes 5 or 6 pieces a year for KCT.
Nice.
But I had a main guy at KCT that would reach out to me. And like when Kobe Bryant passed, there had been a lot of murals painted about Kobe, and also this group, hip hop group, the Visionaries, that I was friends with, this underground hip hop group, but they were one of the most prominent underground hip hop groups. They had actually had a song that mentioned Kobe, but they had also freestyled with Kobe because he was a big hip hop fan.
Okay.
And so like I wrote this piece about Kobe Bryant's impact on the cultural landscape. And actually, did you ever know Danny Bowman? Danielle Bowman from Woodbury? She was an animation student.
No, I don't think so.
She actually won some awards for her animation. But she met Kobe Bryant at the animation, like at these award ceremonies. And so like I talked about these 5 or 6, but I was asked to write about Kobe Bryant's impact on the cultural landscape. And they gave me like a week and a half to do it.
Okay.
But I had these 3 or 4 different stories that I had known about.
I see.
And so, but most of the time I would just write the piece, but like, I have had some times where people hit me on something, said, hey, can you do this and send it in 2 weeks? And if there's some pay involved and it's for a cool publication, I'll do it.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. It's nice to know someone's expecting something from you. There's payment waiting for you, you know, that can get you motivated to go. Okay. Very cool.
Well, you know, I think the old fashioned of just writing the piece first is the most honest, and it is the most, not that the other way isn't honest, but I mean, it's the most true to your heart, or it's the most true to your writing path. And it'll find a way to be published, and it'll find a way to make its way out into the world. And so I think if writers are true to themselves, then along the way you meet editors, you meet publishers, and they might help you fine tune things. But to listen to your own heart, I think is a great starting point to really get the ball rolling as a writer.
That's amazing. Yeah. I think I totally agree with that. Because I switched from architecture to writing full time, I think it was 2018. So that's not that long ago. But before that I had a blog. I was just doing my own, you know, putting stuff on Medium, putting stuff on like my own website for free. And, but that's what really connected with Paul at ArtConnect, the founder director at ArtConnect, is I had all this stuff I could send him and that he could read. And it was about architecture and it was about things. And so going there and I think just seeing someone like, okay, this guy loves writing. He does it anyway. He's doing it for free. This is part of who he is. You know, these pieces I would like to see in my site was one of the things he told me. Cause I used to do the ArtConnect had this little blog you could do for free. It wasn't really published on anything, but you could just kind of create an account. And so I would write stuff and he was telling me like, yeah, sometimes we would see stuff and like, oh, that'd be cool if that was like on our actual site.
Yeah. Amazing.
It was that act of writing. And I'm hoping because we're boarding on an hour here, Mike, I want to be respectful of your time. I really think that point for just creative people listening to this, architecture students, young professionals, older professionals, that point about sitting down, getting the work out, getting past that, getting comfortable with something not looking good right when it comes out, but being able to refine it and work on it and develop craft. Because I'm just curious,
craftsman.
Yeah, exactly. Like I'm curious your thoughts on how to think about developing a craft over time, that we might not be masterful at something today, but that through practice or through diligence, we can get to a place of competency or a place where we start to be happy with what we're doing. Yeah.
100%. You're completely right about the diligence and the repetition. I write 5 haiku every day and I've been doing that since 2016. And the haiku, of course, are the little 3-line Japanese poems, you know, that were often about nature, but I do a lot of informal ones. I might even just write a haiku about, you know, when I'm coming to pick up my daughter from school or you know, but I'm really big on the repetition and I write at least a page in my journal every day and I write my 5 haiku every day. And, I think the only way to become good is to do it over and over and over and over again. And, I studied with some really great poetry scholars and I studied with some crafts, you know, my graduate advisor, she was an amazing poet and I studied with her. But at the same time, first things first, I wrote hundreds and hundreds of poems. And so I do think there is no substitute for pounding the pavement. There's no substitute for sitting down and doing it. And as you do it every day and over time, you become better and better and better. And it's a muscle. You're developing the muscle. And also when you have the joy of doing that, like I love to do it over and over and over again. And as I write the 5 haiku a day, you know, some of them are better than others, but I'm like, well, the point is if I do 5 haiku every day over the course of a year, it's still 1,700 haiku. So even if half of them suck, I'm still getting better.
Amazing. Ray Bradbury had this thing where he would say, write a short story a week, which to me just seems impossible. But if you write it, he's like, if you write a short story a week for a year, you're going to have a good short story in there somewhere is what he would say.
It's completely true.
I could be here for another hour, 2 hours with you and we might have to do a part two.
Let's do a part two soon enough. Hey, Sean, I really appreciate you, bro. And man, you're doing fantastic work. And this podcast is wonderful, but also with all of your writing and your architectural writing, but your fiction writing. And I see a really bright future for you, man. And you're a great man of community and you bring a lot of joy. So thank you for what you're doing, because we need not just positive voices out there, but we need these conversations. We need to be thinking about these things and talking about these things. So thank you for you and your work, bro.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you. I appreciate that. Especially coming from you. And any parting words for the listeners?
You know, we're going to do a second edition of Letters to My City that just has 2 new essays and a teaching guide that's coming out next month. And I'm finishing my next 2 manuscripts right now, but, I wrote a long essay about Mike Davis, and that's going to be in the new edition of Letters to My City, and some of my personal reflections of working with him and knowing him over the years. And I'm going to be doing an event on the Los Angeles River on May 27th, and we're going to have a few of my friends reading poems with us too.
Where's that going to be, the Los Angeles River?
It's going to be in Frogtown Atwater area, kind of where, you know, just below Dodger Stadium.
Okay.
And I think it's going to be 7:30 that night, and I forget the exact address of the space right now, but I'll be posting about it on my different social media sites. And I'm always you know, doing a few different readings. The other day I was at Cal State Northridge. The next day I was at Golden West College. So there's always some different readings going on. But if anybody's out there, feel free to contact me. Or there's a lot of events, and the readings are a good way to kind of connect to the literary world. And some of them are, you know, you meet other writers and you hear other people too. And so, part of is why I do so many readings is it's a way to interact with people.
Excellent. Excellent. And where can we find you online? If we want to follow you on social or website, where should everyone go?
At Mike, the Poet LA is my, my Instagram handle and at Twitter. And, I have a website, aliveinlosangeles.com. Okay. And my book is on Amazon. And also there's going to be, as I said, there's a part two, there's a second edition coming. And there's two more books that I'm working on right now that are pretty close to being done. So one is a book of poems and one's a book of essays. And so the grind continues.
awesome. Well, thank you, Mike. And just to stick around, but I appreciate the conversation. It's been awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sean. It was really great to connect with you, man. And I'm looking forward to more, and we will continue more, man. And I still want to walk around downtown LA with you sometime.